Okay, welcome to the fourth part of our Ethical World of Dr. Seuss series. This week we're discussing Horton Hatches the Egg, Nature versus Nurture, Adoption, and Biological Parenthood. This is the second Horton book that we'll be studying. Recently, one of the Lost Tales of Dr. Seuss came out. It was another Horton book. I haven't read it yet.
What pet should I get?
No, it was another Horton book.
Oh.
What Pet Should I Get came out most recently, but about a year before or so, there was another Horton book came out. And I don't know what it's called, but I saw it in the store. So maybe we'll have to do it for next year. In the meantime, I will summarize the story. Most of us are familiar. The book is about Horton, who is an African elephant who is convinced by Maisie, the lazy, irresponsible bird, to sit on her egg while she takes a short break, which turns out into a permanent relocation to Palm Beach. Naturally, this absurd sight of the elephant sitting on top of the tree makes quite a scene. Horton's exposed to all the elements, ridicule. He's laughed at by jungle friends, the same ones who tried to destroy his other pals, the miniature pals in the Horton Hears a Who saga. Captured by hunters, he's forced to endure a terrible sea voyage, and finally he's placed in traveling circus. Mm-hmm. But despite his hardships and Maisie's clear intent not to return, Horton refuses to leave the nest because he insists on keeping his word. I meant what I said, and I said what I meant, and elephant's faithful 100%. Traveling circus ends up visiting near Maisie's new Palm Beach residence. She visits the circus just as the egg is due to hatch, and at that moment demands that Horton return it. This shear could just very well be about surrogacy as well, but here we're talking about a separate topic, without offering him a reward. However, when the egg hatches, the creature that emerges is an elephant bird, a cross between Horton and Maisie, and Horton and the baby are returned happily to the jungle, rewarding Horton for his persistence while Maisie is punished for her laziness, ending up with nothing.
Oh, my goodness.
And that's the story of Horton Hatches the Egg. What's incredible about this story, why I found this interesting to do, is because this is specifically testing the distinction between who is the bigger parent, who is the more important parent, and what role adoptive parents have versus biological parents. Generally speaking, although we're not going to get too much into that, biological parenthood, you don't forfeit those rights of kibbutz va'eim unless a father or mother instruct a child to do something that is specifically against their monetary or well-being in any way, or against halacha. A child really has the obligation of kibbutz va'eim, and the parent is the parent, and that has halachic ramifications. But there are certain times in which the adoptive parent also is viewed as a parent, and that's what I want to explore today, both from a halachic as well as a hashkafic side. We're going to start a little bit from some of the background and some of the hashkafic elements to this topic. We'll go into some of the halachic considerations, certainly not a complete discussion, and in the end we'll come back to revisit one of my favorite examples, what I call adoptive parenthood in the Torah. Where do we see Chazal talk about adopting a child? So the Chazal in two locations, one is in Maseches Sanhedrin, the other is a Gemara in Megillah, Daf Yud Gimel Amud Aleph. And the Gemara is talking about Batya, the daughter of Paro. The assumption is that she's a Yehudiah. The pasuk in Divrei Hayamim is quoted here, V'ishto ha-Yehudiah yalda es yered avi gedor. Who's avi gedor?
Moshe.
Yeah, Avigdor. So she gave, this Jewish woman gave birth to Avigdor, v'eschever avi shocho v'esikuti al avi zanuach, v'edla b'nei Batya bas Paro, asher lukach mered. These are the children of Batya. So the Gemara first deals with why she's called Yehudiah. Maybe she left Avodah Zarah. Maybe she converted, right? And then it says afterwards, Yolda, look at the bold print. She gave birth to this child. She didn't give birth to Moshe. Vaha Rabui Rabbi say, so Lomar Lecha Shekola Magadol Yosem V'Yisoma B'soch Beso Maila Lavakasu Kilo Yolda. So what is the Gemara coming to tell you? It tells you this very important point. Even though Batya wasn't the biological mother of Avigdor, of Moshe, the Gemara is coming to teach us that anyone who raises an orphan or an orphaness, a boy orphan or a girl orphan in their house, it's as if they gave birth to them. So already we have a statement that, if you had to judge this statement, would you say it's a halachic statement? You say it's a philosophical statement. It's not clear, right?
Well, it seems philosophical.
Right? It seems philosophical. It's an interesting statement. We're going to see later on, actually, there is this question of ki'ilu or malal of a kasuv, whether or not we consider that to be halachic ideal or whether that's just sort of philosophical connection. But at least the Gemara attributes, and by the way, the Gemara in Sanhedrin talks about Rus, I believe. So we see that there are other instances, Rus and Naomi, and we see we have other instances in which we have what's called this sort of adoptive style parenting that is not exactly a biological parenting, and Batya is accredited with being the parent of Moshe to this degree.
However, Moshe is not an orphan.
Right. Moshe is not an orphan either.
He's a disappeared child, and more like, you know, like an Argentine.
So would you conclude that the word orphan does not necessarily limit it to cases in which the parents are no longer alive? Yeah. In other words, according to the Gemara, you would be considered an orphan in this regard, even if your parents are still alive. They're just not active in the life of the child.
Right, but the problem here is
it's
that...
It's the next source.
Right.
Is it?
Yeah.
So anyway, it's not in the next source.
Well, yeah, afilu yesh lo avaim, it says.
Well, right. I'm sorry, it is. I didn't realize I put it next. I thought it was later on. So Shilas Yaivitz writes that, what does it mean? Megalo shim shamayim sharei hu vada ki'ilu yaldu. Not just an orphan. The Gemara is giving a case about an orphan, but the Gemara is saying an orphan, but the halacha is lav davka. It includes even someone who has parents. So even if you have parents, but you're being raised by other parents, the people who are raising you are considered as if they gave birth to you. That's the statement that first appears in the Gemara in Megillah and Sanhedrin. Okay, so this is our first source. If we want to try to put things into perspective.
Yeah, except avelus for such parents is voluntary. It's not required. So this,
says who? Well, we'll see. We'll see sources later on. If you'll stay around for the end part, if you're around for the end part, you'll see this is a bit of a discussion. But it could be. Anyway, in Bereishis Perek Zion, so we learn about a woman who could not give birth. Her name is Sarai. Sarai is Avram lo yaldo lo v'lo. Shivcha Mitzris Ushma Hagar, but she had a maidservant named Hagar. Tomer Sarai al Avram, and Sarai said to Avram, Hinei no atzarani Hashem iledes. God has not given me the ability to give birth. Bono el shivcha si ulai banem mimena. Let me be built from her. As literally, I'll be built from her. So already in the discussion of surrogacy, but here we see the idea that Sarai. We see the idea that Sarai realized she couldn't have children, and she wanted to have children, and even if it meant that it was going to be the biological material of another mother and her husband. Now, by the way, some Mefarshim point out that the situation is different, that if you're a maidservant, so you really basically work for the woman of the house anyway, so it's a little closer than just adoptive parent. It would be a more... integral connection, because part of the maidservant's responsibilities might be to bring children to family. Where else do we see this repeated, by the way? Which of the matriarchs, when she couldn't give birth? Rachel and Bilhah.
Right.
Bilhah was the maidservant of Rachel. Also, her job was to bring about children for her. So now...
Well, and Zilpah and Leah, too. I mean,
right, but Leah had children.
Yeah.
So the role was not as necessary, but yeah. That's in source 4. In source 5, we have the interesting event in which Avram and Sarai, 5 and 6, had their names changed. Lo ikare od shimcha Avram, v'aya shimcha Avraham ki Avamon goyim nisaticha. Your name will now be Avraham. He's granted a letter He in his name, and his name becomes Avraham. And Sarai similarly is changed with a He. Your name is not Sarai. Your wife's name is not Sarai anymore. Rather, lo tikrot shema Sarai ki Sarah shema. Her name is now Sarah.
Because of having children?
That's interesting. Well, we'll talk about why that is in a moment. The Chazal deal with this. But the basic premise behind the name change is that Avram is called the Av Hamon Goyim, is that Avraham means you're now a father to many nations. Right? Now, when did this happen?
Well...
The covenant of the curse.
Right?
After.
Meaning,
after Isaac was then born.
Right, but I'm saying, when is this happening? It's Bris Ben and Besarim, covenant of the parts. But it's happening after this. First, we read about them being barren. Then we learn about that they get a name change. Mm-hmm. Certainly, Sarai is changed Sarah beforehand. Mm-hmm. And if you hand me a chumash, just to verify, I think it's correct. But either way, the point is that they're given these titles which represent their parenthood to a multitude of people beyond their own biological children, right? And that's critical. One second.
I thought the Avhamon Goyim was his biological children, Yishmael and Yitzchak.
They were of Abraham.
No, the assumption, Avhamon Goyim usually means that you have many nations come from you, right? But this is before the...
Avram's child, just they were not
father. That Avram is not many nations. Avram is the father, is some sort of covenantal father to many nations. Yeah. This is before Yitzchak is born. So all of a sudden, both Avram and Sarah are somehow becoming fathers and mothers of nations. Chazal Darsh and Nehe is having to do with other nations. Rashi tells us, by the way, by Chava, go back to Chava, she is called Chava ki hi haisa em kol chai. You can't argue that Chava is a parent. Chava is the parent of every one of us. Mm-hmm. She's the mother of all. She's the biological mother of all of us. She is the em kol chai. There's the Chassidim often talk about how the distinction between Chava and Chaya, that Chava is her name, but one of the nicknames for Sarah other than Yiska is also called Chaya, which is interesting because she's not a biological parent to the world at that point, but she is a what the Rav goes on to call covenantal parent. I want to look at a passage from the Rav who discusses this.
Can I ask a question? Well, I'm really troubled by this passage about Moshe because, I mean, he's adopted by the...
Right, by Batya.
Yeah, but the problem with that is her father is the one who caused this dreadful edict to kill all the males. So, you know, she's not just an adoptive... I mean, she got the child because of her father's evil actions. I mean, you know, he wanted to wipe out...
However, it came to her, okay.
And then, so then he...
Why is that relevant?
Because...
Does it matter?
Sure it does, because...
What matters?
Okay.
But anyway, let's...
I mean, if for one thing, so then she establishes a covenantal relationship with Moses.
Right.
That's very problematic. And, I mean, if you look at, like, Argentina, the disappeared children, I mean, that's the kind of situation that this is setting up. Like, it's okay, you know, you make an edict.
I'm not sure it's rationalizing, infanticide or anything. I think it's saying that here was a righteous girl who found a boy, raised this boy, kept him alive, and because of that, she's considered to be the parent. That's a very, just leave it as is. It's not rationalizing or justifying, you know, genocide or infanticide. I don't think so.
These other people, were they also in the pasuk? Are they also biological or are they also adopted? These, if you look at the pasuk, Chever, Avi Socho, Avi Kutiel, Avi Zenoach, they're also biological, they are?
I'm not sure. Divrei Yom list those as the children of Paro. I don't know who they are. I'm not sure. It could be. They were listed off as the children of Batya. I'm not certain. I know the Gemara, I think, talks about it someplace. I don't remember where that is, though. In Source 9, we have an interesting passage from the book Family Redeemed, Rabbi Soloveitchik. Mother's job changed into a great mission. Her preoccupation with the child was endowed with the ethical meaning. She not only nurses the child physically, she brings him up, she assumes the role of educator. Motherhood is not only an experience, but a commitment as well. At this juncture, motherhood is hallowed on account of another idea, which is linked up with the spontaneous free choice of motherhood on the part of a woman in the covenantal community. As mother teacher, the woman is no more connected with only the fruit of her womb, with the child she bore. As long as motherhood, like fatherhood, was rooted in biological facticity, its confine was very narrow and extended only to a clan. One can experience biological motherhood only in respect to one's own child. However, when motherhood was transformed into a commitment and being a mother was equated with being a teacher, an apostle of God, the carrier of God's covenant, his prophet, then motherhood, like fatherhood, was elevated to a universal spiritual level. Instead of being just the father and mother of their offspring in a clannish sense, Abram and Sarah accepted responsibility for the multitudes, for the world community of the committed. The father and mother of the clan were promoted to father and mother teachers of the entire covenantal community with all its universal aspirations. The letter He was added to both their names, signifying a transformation to universality. God promised Abraham that he would be a father of many nations, and that Sarah shall give rise to nations, rulers of peoples shall be of her. Keep going. Sarah replaced Eve. The freely committed universal mother supplanted the instinctually involved natural mother. Eve was the mother of all living, Sarah the mother of nations and kings. Eve's motherhood consisted in giving life in a natural sense to her child. It lacked, however, the element of leadership. Her motherhood was a result of biological pressure, the consummation of a natural process. Sarah's was due to a great vision, to a new mission she took on. She and all the persons they had acquired in Haran and children pupils formed a covenantal community, one founded on education, a living tradition, and commitment. Sarah deemed the motherhood experience by taking a factum, a natural reality, and changing it into a commitment. Passive involvement became an active commitment. Natural entanglement was elevated to a normative choice. The woman herself rose from a receptive to an active role. And the most important dimension which was added is that of the universality, the capacity to assume motherhood vis-a-vis all children. No more should a childless couple feel desolate and forsaken because the Almighty has not blessed them with an heir. The barren woman may lack the natural motherhood experience, but she can attain covenantal, if not natural, motherhood by choice, by commitment, by helping others, by contributing towards strengthening of the covenantal community, by exposing children of their other parents to the Word of God. Now, he's going to say something that's a little confusing here, which sounds like he's against adoption, but it's not necessarily meaning that. He's against an ancient notion of adoption established by the Romans. The Romans, to whom the idea of covenant was alien, who in spite of their advanced technological achievements never freed themselves from the bonds of natural community, tried to compensate the childless man and woman by establishing the institution of adoption. Judaism did not need to create such an institution. We didn't, as a whole, create the institution. The letter hey added to Abram and Sarah's name symbolized the exalted idea of covenantal father and motherhood, one which is realized not through natural but through spiritual educational media, which transcended the boundaries of a clan and extended into the open spaces of universality. It's a beautiful piece, but he talks about what parent. It also touches on something important, which we'll come to later on, which is what is the essence of being a parent. Many people in the world have donated their genetic material to bring children in the world that they haven't parented, they haven't taken no responsibility for, or didn't have the ability or the opportunity to take responsibility for. But a covenantal parent, which doesn't necessarily link biological material and have that sort of natural, visceral satisfaction that parents get from watching their DNA be replicated, it has a much more meaningful and in God's eyes, a more spiritual notion when you engage in this covenantal sort of fatherhood or motherhood. The Lubavitcher Rebbe, who himself was not blessed with children, who himself was not, for whatever reason, he had not interest in adopting, but is widely considered to be a father of thousands and thousands and thousands of Jews in the world. To rob him of that experience of being a parent would be to deny the second half of parenthood, which would be covenantal parenthood. In Source 10, we see the Rambam, in Hilchos Talmud Torah, talks about the obligation. Kishem shechayv adam lamed es beno, kach luchayv lamed es ben beno, shenemar v'odatam levanecha levnevanecha. You have to teach your grandchild Torah, not just your son. V'lo beno uven beno bilvad, not just your son or your grandson. Ela mitzvah al kol chacham v'chacham Yisrael, lamed es kol talmidim, afa b'shenem banav. You teach all students, even if they're not their children. As it says, v'shinamtam levanecha, mipiyah shemo alamdu, banecha, elu talmidecha. Banecha means your students. Sh'talmidim kruin banim. Talmidim are called sons, right? Anyway, so here he says this idea that you have an obligation to teach all people, and all of them are considered like your children when you teach. When you engage in what the Rav talks about, covenantal parenthood, of education, of inspiration, of connecting someone to God, you basically become a parent to that person. But only when you engage in spiritual endeavor of education. The Gemara in Sanhedrin is the one I referenced earlier in a different vein, writes here that Amar Rabbi Shmuel bar Nachmeni, Amar Rabbi Yonasan. By the way, it's Nachmeni is an interesting person here mentioned because Nachmeni sometimes is a reference to Abaye, who himself was adopted, which we'll see later on. Komalam bin Chavero Torah, anyone who teaches his son Torah, Ma'ala lavakasu kilo yaldu, Shnemar ve'ela toldas Aaron Moshe, Ksiv ve'ela shmos bnei Aaron, Lomar lecha Aaron yalad, Moshe limed. Why are they called the children of Moshe if he was teaching Aaron's sons? Because he taught Torah to Aaron's sons, and therefore he became the parent to Aaron's sons as well. So this is the hashkafic background to this. There are, of course, this is a very vast topic. I want to go through some of the halachic considerations, and it's not an exhaustive topic, treatment, but we will see what we can in the time that we have remaining. One of the issues that comes up in Poskim is the question of mourning an adoptive parent. Rav Schwartz wrote an article two issues ago in the RGJ Journal on adoption, and in which he quotes, and only Rav Schwartz has the ability to quote these far-fetched American Poskim that people have never heard of. He has the greatest sense of American of Shalos Tshuvos from the United States that I've ever seen. So Divrei Emes, or Tzvi Shimon Albon, or of Shimon Albon. He writes here a quote that he quotes from the Ridvaz. The Ridvaz was a Rav by the turn of the century in Chicago, of course. He was a bit Harif, but he was also ousted out of Chicago. He was thrown out. When I was contemplating coming here and I got a job here and I was talking to Rav Willig about Chicago, he goes, oh, just be careful. Chicago, it's in Eretz Ochel Sus Yoshvea. The Ridvaz was thrown out of Chicago. It's 100 years ago, but yeah. So the Ridvaz made a statement. He says, Matzasi makom lahed mash shemati ma'anashim ne'manim ki hora ha-Ridvaz lahayasum shenizgadol besoch beso shel ha-manoch. He writes, Shemes below banim. So now a person was raising a yasom, but he died without any biological children. He says he's chayev that if there is no other children to say kaddish, he would be chayev in that case. There's a larger dispute in the Achronim, but to sit shiva for the parents because there is no one else. So he quotes this idea in the Gemara from Sanhedrin that if you raise an orphan, the orphan and the parents don't have any other children, the children have an obligation to mourn for the parents. And Vimkein who Mikri Zari is called his zera. He says Tzarach Hayasom Shegidol Besoch Beis Oleshiv Shiva Acharav. Nei Af Ki BeEmes LaNav Alav VeEin Mat Tzarach LaVer Tauso. He says I don't really believe he's correct, and there's no reason to explain his mistake. We're worried about several stumbling blocks, and he raises one major stumbling block, which seems like an ancillary issue, seeming easy enough to verify, but nonetheless we should read what it is. What's going to happen is when a person dies childless, right?
When a man dies childless,
so what's the status? The wife now has to go, if there's a younger brother who's not married, and there's no issue of a tzara, of a co-wife, they can't marry, the wife now falls before the younger brother, and if she doesn't want to do it, nowadays we don't do yibum, she does chalitza. Yeah. So what's the concern here? They see someone sitting shiva, so you can say, ah, he had children, so there's no reason for the mitzvah, and then you're going to miss out on the chiyuv to do chalitza, and it's a problem for her to marry anyone else before doing chalitza. So that's his concern. Whether this is, to me, and I'm a nobody, but this seems to me like a very far-fetched concern, such that we should prevent someone from sitting shiva. But there's a difference between the two. In other words, there could be a case, and some of the posts can talk about, where everybody knows the child was adopted, and they're sitting shiva out of respect, whether it's a chiyuv, whether it's a mitzvah. You know, you might not run into that problem. Yeah.
But both of the books on Avelus that people use today, Rabbi Lamb's book and the Art Scroll book, they say that it's permitted but not required.
Right. And the reason this is somewhere between these two. Whereas what the Ridvaz was saying was it's required, and what Rav Albon was saying, another Chicago rabbi, was saying no, it's actually prohibited. But interesting, you have this debate going on 100 years ago between Chicago rabbis. I thought it was a nice little interaction to bring.
Does it make a difference if the woman can no longer, if she's too old to bear children?
Doesn't matter. She still can't get married without the chalitza. But marriage has more than just bearing children.
I know, but it's an important part because I thought the reason for the chalitza was that.
So there are numerous.
The DNA isn't right. Lost.
There know, are numerous least. Exceptions, yeah. These are all lengthy discussions in one of the largest, most difficult masechtas in Shas. Yevamos, and you're welcome to join us next time around when we get to the Daf Yomi. Yeah. But I don't want to get too much into Yibum right here. It's a good question. So source 13. The Gemara in Yevamos tells us, Amar Mar Ger Shabali Skyer, someone comes to convert, Omrim Lo. Mara Isa Shabali Skyer. So someone who comes to convert, we say to them, why do you want to convert? We give them a hard time. Modim also mixes mitzvahs kalos. Torah is easy sometimes. Mixes mitzvahs chamor. Sometimes it's very difficult. My time, why do we tell them some difficult mitzvahs, some easy mitzvahs? Di parish nifrosh. Because if he separates from Judaism, okay, they won't become Jewish. Damar b'chel b'kashim gerim lisokis apachas. Because converts are very difficult for the Jewish people. Now, this reference is talking in this context means some of us are very lucky to have converts in our midst. But what?
That's why I was laughing.
But what Rabbi Chelbo is referring to is that sometimes you have recidivism, sort of in a person who lived their life in a certain way, got into Judaism and then sort of fell back, because it's very common in Judaism, you kind of wax and wane in your observance. So if a ger does this, it's very bad, because then all of a sudden you have someone who committed to mitzvahs, now they're obligated, and now they're doing a sin. Before they did this, it wouldn't have been a sin, it would have just been life. But now it's considered a bad thing, so it's a very difficult thing. The other explanation of this is that sometimes there are foreign values that seep through that are not, that the fear was it would corrupt the rest of the purity of Jewish society. And so that was a concern, that if someone's bringing in foreign ideas and foreign values and not fully accepting Judaism, that it might be considered a dangerous endeavor to engage in. And indeed, in certain generations, they didn't convert. They were against conversion in certain communities, some Sephardic communities in particular. In certain generations, they were very prone to conversions, were very common. So this sort of activity would wax and wane throughout history. But the point of this is quoted in the poskim because it becomes an important question in terms of reasons why when considering conversion, and we're going to get to this when we see Rav Moshe, Source 15, why perhaps we might want to consider, like if you have the ideal to adopt Jewish children or non-Jewish children, one reason why you may want to adopt Jewish children is because you don't have to go through the conversion. Now, the sugya in the Gemara in Ksuvah stuff, Yud Aleph Min Aleph talks about the sugya of a ger katan, converting a young child. The Gemara basically assumes that it's permissible to convert a young child, al das beistin, without even consulting with the child, assuming they grew up with nothing else. Right? So for most children who are 2 years old, they've never understood the life of a cheeseburger. And so it's a merit to convert them. It's very simple. But when it comes to someone who is 15 years old, right, so they've already understood and now they want to convert. So yeah, you need. So at that point, at a certain point, when you've tasted the time of Isser, namely 13 or 12 years old, the age of adolescence, we usually refer to that as the time of Isser, at that point you need to give your consent if you want to convert. So this becomes an important. So we'll see if this applies by adoption. But it's the assumption in general by Ger Katan. Let's say there is a family that is all converting, right? They're upgrading, they had a conservative conversion. The whole family is converting together, right? And they're all going to keep an observant life. So generally speaking, we don't require them to go back. It's a machlokas rishonim to go back at age 13 or 12 and say they confirm they're not going to, right? But this might be a different case when it comes to adoption. And that's what I want to introduce this idea.
Wouldn't it be preferable to adopt a Jew if you have a choice? Because otherwise, what would happen to that child?
So we're going to talk about both the benefits and of adopting a Jew and the benefits of adopting a non-Jew. We'll talk. Yeah.
I was going to say two big poskim in Chicago. One says you shouldn't adopt a non-Jew because you're going to end up with issues that you're talking about, and Gedalia Dov Schwartz says it's better to adopt a non-Jew because you're not going to
run. We will see that. It's a very important machlokas. We'll see that in just a moment. The Chachma Shlomo Kluger, in his comment in the very beginning of Evan Ezer, the very first piece here, by Mitzvah Prurvu, he writes here something fascinating. Towards the end of the piece, he says, V'hine nistapakti, the second line, the last line before the really wide lines. I have a suffix. If you have an orphan and you raise an orphan in your house, you raise an adopted child, in other words, is this considered pruvu? Right? Parents can't have children, but is it considered pruvu if you have an adoptive child? He says that's a suffix, because maybe you even are. The fact that he even brings it as a suffix, he says this ties down to a machlokis, Taz and others, whether you say, when we talk about ki'ilu, that's kilu holy banim, kilu yoli banim, that when you adopt a yasim yisoma, that it's as if you've given to children yourself. So the question is that just a philosophical statement, or is it like a halachic statement? And that's what we saw earlier on. And here he brings down the suffix. He says it's possible even your makayim peruvu, which is an amazing, a very interesting and amazing chiddush.
Aaron Soloveitch said,
said you're Mekayim Peruvot. So that's like one side in the Chachma Shlomo and the Shlomo Kluger.
Does the child have to be Jewish for that to hold?
No.
Would it still be a question?
Lechara not. Lechara, that would make no difference. That wouldn't make a difference.
And you need two boys, a boy and a girl?
Ah, so that's a separate issue. It's a separate issue. So the different shittos on what Peruvu is that you have to go through all of Ebenezer. Is it two boys? Is it a boy and a girl? Is it having a grandchild? You know, it's all different kinds of, and there are many ways to fulfill it also, right? So also beyond the scope, I don't want to go too much into it, but look into Ebenezer. Rav Moshe Feinstein, in a number of tshuvos, this is one of the most prominent ones, talks about the importance of the origin of the child. Is it better that the child should be Jewish if you adopt, or is it better the child should be not Jewish? So Rav Moshe is a little bit in a couple locations. And he named a davar inyan adoptirin, kinder, adopting children. Keofen she'osim medina zu yesh inyan shelo tov b'shel yelad Yisrael velo tov b'shel yelad nachum. There's one aspect in which it's not good to get a Jewish child, and there's a certain aspect it's not good to get a non-Jewish child. And each issue is different. Let's talk about what are the problems that come up by adopting a Jewish child. You have to know he's not a mamzer, because you don't want to make more mamzerim in Israel, unless you're part of the international based team. Velo shtuki, velo sufi. Or not shtuki and not a sufi. These are people you don't know the father's origin or the mother's origin. Do lachkor shema ha'em hi eshes ish, shalach baila mimena belo get. Kasher v'zinsa v'yalda shehu mamzer, all these different arayos that took place, different forbidden relationships. So you want to verify the origin of the parents. Avkeshinoda sheim hipnu, even if you know the mother was single, yeshlecho shema haboel u balachosa. Maybe it was a brother and sister, God forbid, who gave birth to the child. Often adopted.
No, balachosa.
I'm sorry. It was the balachosa. In this case, the boel. That was the previous case, Ras. Maybe the boel was the balachosa. Was the husband of meaning when they get married, when the children get married, you might have an arias issue later on. Im yesh la achos nesua, oya ben achia, o ben achosa. Im yesh la krovim, kilu shenigadlu kvar, shurin laholid. So you have to know all their relatives, because later on when shidduch time comes around, they may end up marrying a relative who's forbidden to them, a sister or a brother, right? Even if you know. So he goes through all the possible issues that could exist. And then, go to the third paragraph, v'chisaron zeh leka b'shel nachrim. This problem doesn't exist by non-Jews. There's no issue of mamzeris by non-Jews. Lo iser krovos u'shisgairu. And once they convert, there's no issue of relatives, right? Technically speaking, you can marry a brother and sister on a technical level, whether we'd allow it or not. Brother and sister convert.
Yeah, we wouldn't allow.
Right, but technically speaking, they're not really an issue of. It's definitely not del raisa. On the komakom tzarach laudio kodem ben yud gimel zachar, but kodem bas yud beis lanakeva mishum shur shine as limchos ala gerus. He paskins, nonetheless, you have to tell them prior to 12 by a girl and 13 by a boy that they are adopted, because they at that point can reject the gerus. Because generally speaking, kids don't try to rebel until they're 13 or 12, or until they get Yetzer Hara. So before that it's just like general chutzpah. Once they're adults, that's, I'm independent, I'm going to rebel. So at that point we have to give them a choice. Once they're 13 now, by the way, achar kol yichlo shuv limchos. Once they're 13 or 12 and they say I want to be Jewish, can't go back on that.
What if they weren't told?
So he goes on, aval kishelo yodio osam harei yuchlo limchos l'olam kol zman sheyisvadu. So then you could reject the Judaism. As long as you didn't inform them.
So if you inform them, when do they have to reject it? Before they're 13 or after?
They would have any time after 13. They have to make an active acceptance of Judaism, he says.
Oh, okay.
Or not rejecting it. That's a machlokas also in the Rishonim, but he seems to be saying both. You need to both not reject it and accept it.
But observing one Shabbos is considered accepting it. So
I want to just skip to something on page 5.
Right.
Well, that would be a clever parent. Yeah. But hopefully you did a better job than that. On page 5, Rav Moshe continues, and he says, "Uve'etzem ani mesupek b'lo odiulo she'efshar she'yizvad v'gadluso." I have a doubt if you didn't tell him or her, maybe you can inform them when they're older. She'az yeshlo kfar taivat merubot. She'ein l'smoch l'mar she'anan sadi shelo yimche. So, in other words, normally, if they go a minute, this is the way he paskins, if they go a minute into adulthood and they don't reject it, then it's accepted. Not all Rishonim agree, but not Rishonim agree, but this is Reb Moshe's approach. But if you wait longer than that, then I don't know, he says, that a mere lack of rejection is good enough. You made an act of acceptance, because once you've already enjoyed the Yetzer Hara, at that point, it's not so clear that it's considered a zechus, a merit to be Jewish, because who wants to be Jewish with all these wonderful opportunities out there that are permissible if you're not Jewish? And therefore, maybe you need an active acceptance of Judaism at that point, and a geirus, and to go to mikveh, etc. Maybe, perhaps, he entertains that. The last three lines here are some critical comments. So first of all, of course, if you give birth to a daughter at that point, she will be prohibited to a Kohen, right? Like a Gioris. Vlad Yisraelis, and if it was a child, im Vlad Abbas, if the Vlad was a daughter, so she's ushered to a Kohen. She's considered a Gioris. If the Vlad was a Jewish girl, if she was a non-Jewish girl and you adopted her, she can't marry a Kohen. If she was a Yisraelis, she was born Jewish, right? She yalda me'akum, Vlad Yisraelis, she yalda me'akum, hu Vlad kasher li Yisrael upsul l'kuhuna.
Means she has a Jewish mother and then
not Jewish
father.
So in this case, she's born Jewish, but she doesn't have what's called yichus. So her father's not Jewish, so she can't marry a kohen. We paskin only by yichus, by the father, right? In that case, so yichus comes from the father. If you don't have yichus, you can't marry a kohen. Kohen's a din yichus.
Both parents have to be Jewish to marry a kohen.
A kohen, correct. Vimlatzasi. Now here's where it gets a little bit complicated. If you listen to my advice, tishmu ein sarach lach nizera nachrim. Even though there are many benefits to adopting non-Jewish children over Jewish children, my advice is don't adopt non-Jewish children. There's no need. He's assuming there's plenty of Jewish children to adopt, I guess. Only when a child converts l'shem shamayim on their own, that's when we have to accept them. But I advise not to. It's too messy, he says. Now, I can only guess which posik in Chicago, who is one of the big Talmidim of Reb Moshe Feinstein, gave this advice. But the truth is, Reb Moshe doesn't say it's usher. He says, here's my advice. He went through a lot of benefits to adopting non-Jewish children over Jewish children, and vice versa. He says his advice was it could be messy. Now, every situation is different, obviously, and this is where Reb Moshe ends. Now, there's another issue that comes up, and again, we're just touching the tip of the iceberg with all this. That's the question of naming. So machlokes, whether you call the child after the father. Source 16 and 17, we talk about how Abaye objected to something, and then we see that Nachmeni, that it says Shaper Amar Nachmeni. And Rashi tells us that Abaye is called Nachmeni. And why? Rather, his father, Rava, was called. His adoptive father was called Nachmeni. So why is he called Nachmeni or Bar Nachmeni? Because you're called after your father, even if you're adopted. Abaye was an orphan. Okay. So the Chasam Sofer deals with the question of when you're called up to an Aliyah. And he says that that even though there are certain questions that come into effect, called to an Aliyah, he says that still he feels it's okay to be called up for an Aliyah using the adoptive father's name. So there's a question some people have, do you have to inform people in the community or not? In the Igros Moshe, source 19, he talks about Chasin Shein Yadua Shem Aviv. When the child does not know the father's name, whether or not you can write, whether you should write Avram Avinu, and he says Avram Avinu shouldn't be written because the mashmos is that person's a ger. And the question is whether you write Avraham or not. So he says maybe you should write the mother's name, but then you'll give a bad reputation to the child because you'll say it's a shtuki where the father wasn't Jewish, right? So he deals with this question, but the poskim deal with this in regards to an adopted child also. So we see that the Chasam Sofer is comfortable, at least when calling up for an aliyah, with using the adoptive father's name. In the Shut Mayim Chaim, he talks about writing the name in the ksuva. And he says, Barur b'yoser she'ein shum mania l'chtov shema av mametz. There is no problem in the ksuva to write the name of the adoptive father whatsoever, Kach nauk beyirenu Tel Aviv. This is what we do in Tel Aviv and Yafo. Yesh mishikaz lachshol shem achas v'shom yegilu yidei get. Some are worried about a get. So he goes on and says that even in a get, perhaps you would even write the name of the adoptive father. Pashut HaTam B'chozei says in the second paragraph that ksivas shem ha'av eno halacha l'maisa kol ksivas ohi kadesh yado mimagarish. The reason why you're writing the parents' names, you want to know who's divorcing who. So it's an identity thing. The question is, do you have to write the biological parent also? But he feels not even a makiv by a get, which is even more strict. For a certain, by a ksuva. There are those who say that a ksuva, we have to be concerned when you write a ksuva, that you should be careful not to write the name of an adoptive parent or the wrong parent. Ramosha talks about that by not writing the name of a parent who's not the parent, but certainly poskim who are sensitive about what you write in ksuva would say you don't have to read it out loud if you don't want to embarrass someone. It's like the famous example of a betula. Like a girl, we know she's not a betula, she's not a virgin, she's getting married. So you have to read in ksuva. You have to read that out loud. You may not write in ksuva betula. You do if it's the first time getting married, you write betula anyway. But if you know for a fact she's not a betula, and then some poskim say, and it's yadua, they're living together, then it's yadua, that's not a betula, but still, some say you still write it, others say you don't write it, but you still read it out loud. Because there are always these guys listening to hear what you're writing in the ksuva. Yeah.
Why would it embarrass someone to put the adoptive parent's name? What does that mean? I'm confused.
Not necessarily embarrass. I was talking about the Ramosha case of where a parent is shtuki, where the parent... with a non-Jewish parent or something like that.
You mean if you adopt?
I was not talking about the adoptive case there. I was talking about the embarrassment by other parents, not an adoptive parent, by naming a parent who was maybe not Jewish, or right or.
But how
or
would you, why would
well,
you name,
well, know. No, you're not naming the parent. You would be identifying as Avram Avinu, right? The child is Avram Avinu.
That's what you do when someone converts, right?
Right.
They become
right.
Sarah and Abraham.
Right, right. So the question is, though, the unique case of conversion when it's adoptive parenting is that it seems that certain halachos, some posts can permit writing in the ksuva, sitting shiva, all this stuff that normal privileges that exist by a regular parent. So we see that adoptive parent is different than a regular conversion case, because it has a little more of a parent role than does a regular than as if a person is caring for a convert in their house. It has nothing to do with a child. That was the point. The point is that we have all these nafka minot that might apply by adoptive parenting.
So if you have a Jewish mother and she's single, I mean she's a single woman, but she wants to adopt a child, and she does, and you know the child, well, you know, we call certain things by, say she adopts a boy and he's going to be called up to the Torah. What's the father's name?
Abraham.
I would think Abraham.
Abraham.
But if it's a Jewish child.
If he converts, it would be Avram Avinu.
Yeah, but if it's a Jewish child.
Oh, you're saying if he was born Jewish.
Yeah, he was born Jewish, you have
that's not the question. So if you know the real name, the name of the biological father, you list the biological father.
If you don't,
right? Then you could do it if he converts. Avram Avinu.
But if he's already Jewish and he doesn't convert, so.
Well, you could say Avram, and you know it's correct.
Okay.
Avram's always correct. We're all the children of Avram and Sarah. Which is, by the way, part of what we talked about earlier.
Okay.
One of the other questions that comes up in the poskim is the issue of Yichud. Shut Shevet Alevi Rav Vozner is among many poskim who are concerned about the issue of Yichud. It's very common to have a couple that can't have children. They adopt a boy or a girl to raise them. It's obvious, beyond obvious, he says, that you can't be in seclusion with such a person. Should she have to hire a person in the house to be there all the time, so that way when she's not with her husband, she could be in the same room as her adoptive son, or vice versa with the husband. I don't know if you have to require that. Why? Misha yechida muteres la'ametz la'yeled, and or if a single woman is mutter to adopt a child. In a way, is there a way that's possible to avoid the isra yichud? Kamen du'kfiyos gemura v'gamu nichnala, maybe because you're always around the child, and because, you know, the other considerations here. But at least the Rav Ozner wrote that it was prohibited to be in yichud with an adopted child. The Rav Moshe Feinstein disagreed. Like Kitzur Shulchan Aruch and other poskim say it's not a problem of yichud. Someone raises an orphan in their house, which is a mitzvah gedola, he says. He writes off Misha Megadol Yosem Yisama Kishashkan Shuhu Mitzvah Gedola. Again, he's probably talking about, as we saw from Moshe already, adopting a Jewish child, but still, what he said about a non-Jewish child, doesn't mitigate this idea about the mitzvah gedola. He says there are those who don't want to reveal. Yeshem wrote some legalos lahem klal. Some don't want to tell the children at all. And he goes on. He says that. Could be a big mistake, but he's saying it's a mistake at least by 12, 13. But he says here, he says he's not concerned that it's a yichud problem, right? V'adai tzarech l'adom b'davar ha-yichud av shena kel b'zu, once I'll go upon him, she'osin k'din v'adai tzarech l'adom b'davar ha-yichud av shena kel b'zu b'imnei astam, v'atzarech kam, let me just find the line. He says yichud is not necessarily a problem, but he does say that yichud is more difficult than chibuk and nishuk. Dein zederach tava v'chibas bia el derech chibuk v'nishuk levan of nosav. Shlomo Nosrik says even if you want to say yichud is a problem, it's definitely not a problem to hug and kiss your children, because that's not yichud. Yichud is something that brings about a desire for tashmish, but not hugging and kissing. So again, the poskim, the Gedera poskim, are kind of all over the place on this issue as to whether it is a yichud or not with an adopted child. And Rav Moshe's note that it's not a problem. The Kitzur Shulchan Aruch said, is, among others, Asel Charav, Tshuva Asel Charav, Chaim David Alevi also writes that it's not a problem of yichud. Other poskim were machmir that it is an issue of yichud. I just want to close.
Can I just cite from, and we were looking at the answers ourselves, we were told that it depends when you adopted the kid. We know, if you adopted birth, they said it's no different than as if you had given birth and raised a child.
Right.
But that we've known people who foster parented kids for years, and they were older when they finally were able to adopt them, that they said that was when it might be more of a problem.
Right, right. Rav Moshe talks about this difference as well. He talks about this idea about bringing an adult into your house. All of a sudden, it's a different story, right? You know, you adopt a teenager who's like on the streets, and you bring a teenager into your house. That's a different story. It's not the same type of relationship. Anyway, he says here in the Mashi Yesh in Nizharan Ulai, those who aren't careful about this, Ulai Samchan Mibne Hadchak, Al Zesh, Akemish, Megadol, Sakibito, Lo Yitzel Kakal, Mitzah, Jerotza, Betovasa. No one who raises a child as a child wants to ruin them in a manner that would be about a riot, in a manner of inappropriate sexual misconduct, because you love the person. You don't want to hurt them. That's the assumption. So already he says there's no concern here that there may not be concern about Yichud in that case. I want to just close on an Ashkafic idea with which we began, but going to one of the more, maybe less, but more prominent cases in Tanakh of what I call adoption. We read the story of Rus, and the opening and the closing of the Megillah is very telling about these two types of parenting that we speak about. And I think the book of Rus is not just a book about being a nice person in relationships, but it's also very much a book about parenting. The book of Rus begins, "Vayhi bimei shefota shoftim, vayhi ra'abar, tzveilach ish mbit lachem Yehuda, lagur b'stei Moav, hu v'ishto shnei banav." So, perfect story, a picturesque family, and there was a star famine in the land, and they go to live in a place called Stei Moav because there was no more bread in Beit Lechem. The Medrash points out that they didn't want to feed all the hungry Jews, so they decided to take their money and go to live amongst the Goyim with their children. Shema Ish Elimelech, Shem Ishto Naomi. The man was Elimelech, the wife was Naomi. Shem Bnei Banav, Machlon Chilion, and they named those beautiful children Disease and Destruction, Machlon Chilion. So already they're being influenced by the culture. They don't name the children. They leave Eretz Yisrael. They name their children poorly. They Moav, and they live in Moav. Then Elimelech dies. And now she's left with the two sons and their wives. And they married two sons. And they get married. They married two Moavi women. Right? The nightmare come true of the parent. Shemachat Orpah, Shemshenit Rut. Orpah and Rut are the new spouses, and they are not Jewish. And whether they convert later on, whether Rut converts at what stage she converts is a different question. But she definitely converts at some point. She's the quintessential convert. And they were there for 10 years, and then the two boys died. So here, this poor mother-in-law is left behind with two daughter-in-laws, which is already is the most distant relationship that you could establish, right? Mother-in-law and daughter-in-law. But they're not Jewish, and the sons are dead. So there's no reason to be connected whatsoever to this, right? Usually at that point, that's when you part ways with the in-laws, right? There's no longer the biological connection to the in-laws. There's no reason to connect it. So strange happens in the story, though, right? What happens next? So Ruth and Naomi decide they're going to come along. But eventually, Naomi says, Rus and Orpah come along, but Naomi says, listen, Orpah, and Rus, you don't have to stay with me. So Orpah goes home, and Rus holds on to her mother-in-law. Mm-hmm. It's also very bizarre. Mm-hmm. So she goes, and they go to Beit Lechem Yehuda, and they live together and living on the floor, and she's running, living in the threshing floor, and she's collecting food for the poor, for her and her mother-in-law. And eventually, her mother-in-law decides to give her dating advice, right, how to put on lipstick and how to pick up a guy. And she meets Boaz. And because of the advice of this mother-in-law to date another guy other than her son, it's an amazing story. Ruth gets married. And Boaz takes Ruth and they have a child. And then we read the end of the story. It's shocking. Vayikach Boaz is Ruth. Verse 24. Boaz took Rus, Vadhila Lisha, Vayavoila, Vaitena Shem La Herayon Vatelid Ben. And they have another son. They have a son. But Tomarna Nashim al Naomi. Now they turn to Naomi, the mother-in-law, and they say, Baruch Hashem Asher Loishbis Lach Goel Hayom Vikaresh Mob Israel. And they call the name, right? Vayalach Meshiv Lemeshiv Nefesh, Uchakela Sevasech, Ki Chalasech Asher Avasech, Avasech. Yeladato. Sure, he tov aloch mishiv abanim. But he kach no mezi yeld. She takes the child in her arms. Vatishi sehu becheka. But he lo omenes. And she nurses this baby, who's not her biological child, but is rather the child of her ex daughter-in-law from her son, who's deceased. But vatigrena lo hashchenot shem. And the neighbor is called it a name. Lemor yulad ben lanomi. A son has been called Naomi. Vatigrena. Shimon, she names the child, the chutzpah, the mother-in-law names the child, Oved, who Avi Yishai, Avi David. And Oved has a son named Yishai, who has a son named David HaMelech. So, before we go on in the rest of the story, what is fascinating about this close of the story is you have a woman who had her own children biologically. And what happened to those children? They died. Was she a good parent? Well, she named them poorly. She brought them up in a negative environment. She sent them to the wrong kinds of schools, and they're gone. And then she has a daughter that she sort of adopts as her daughter. I call that Rus. She takes her on. She cares for her. She gives her advice. And they care for each other. It's a beautiful relationship. And eventually, that adoptive daughter, Rus, has a baby. And when that happens, we call the child Naomi's son. Okay, let's go on the story for a moment, and then we'll contrast. Look at Pasuk Yud Zayin. Oved has a son named Yishai, has a son named David. Vela told us Paritz, and here are the descendants of Paritz. Paritz holid etz Chetzron, that was from Yehuda. Chetzon holidus Ram, Ram holid, not Emmanuel. Ram holidus Aminadav, Aminadav holidus Nachshon, Nachshon holidus Salma, Salmon holidus Boaz, Boaz holidus Ovad, Ovid holidus Yishai, Yishai holidus David. So that's the origin of David listed twice, once in Pasuk Yud Zayin and once from Yud Ches all the way to Chav Beis. Why do we do the lineage twice? It's a strange sort of story. So look at the words. One word is used is that it says that Vatikrena Shmo Oved Hu Avi Yishai Avi David. The first description I would say is one type of relationship. That is the relationship all the way from Naomi to David. Now the relationship of Naomi and David, it doesn't actually work through DNA,
no,
does it?
No.
Naomi has a son, not her son. She picks up her estranged her ex daughter-in-law's son and calls it her son. And that son has a son who has a son named David. And then the next story is a story of biology, of holid. Holid is to give birth, literally, with the word. That goes all the way back to Yehuda, Peretz, right? And Chetzron. And it goes back to Ram. And all these people, eventually you get to David. David is the product of two different types of creations. He is the biological product all the way from Boaz. Boaz, who marries Ruth, is the biological parent. Now, Ruth is also a biological parent. But who is the covenantal parent?
Naomi.
Naomi is given credit in birth. The story of Rus is the story from which a woman, Naomi, moves from being a biological parent to a covenantal parent. She starts out being a biological parent. She's no good at it, like a lot of parents in this world. The horrible stories you hear. And she learns to be a real parent to someone who's not even her own DNA. And she becomes the mother of the Melech HaMashiach. An amazing story of how real parenting is not just about DNA, but rather the product of love, care, and concern. And so you have here a lot of halakhic considerations. I just touched the tip of the iceberg here. But you do have a very important ethic that I think Rav Soloveitchik talks about, and I think which speaks, which is also the centerpiece of the story of Rus, which regardless of the various halachic considerations one has to ask their posik, you do have a very important message that emerges for the biological, for the covenantal parent, the adoptive parent, and the relationship they share with the child.